Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The South China Sea has been a contentious part of the world in recent years. China has backed its expansive territorial claims with island building and also naval patrols. Meanwhile, the U.S. has sent military ships and planes near the disputed islands. The U.S. calls them freedom of navigation operations to ensure access to key shipping and air routes. Well, both sides have accused each other of militarizing the South China Sea. How does the current South China Sea dispute fit into the broader landscape of maritime conflicts? That's a question we want to look at today with my guest. Sarah Mitchell is the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Her research focuses on international conflict and maritime issues, among other areas. She joins me in the studio today. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I want to mention that we'll talk about this, too. You're also co-director of something called the Issue Correlates of War Project, if I got that right.
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, before we get into maritime conflicts, sort of a deep dive, ask you briefly about the U.S. releasing its annual National Security Strategy Report on Monday. President Trump gave a speech about it. It claims that China and Russia are, quote, revisionist powers that pose primary threats to U.S. security. This is a 68-page report that also deemed China's trade policies to be a threat to American prosperity and tantamount to, quote, economic aggression. A little bit more on the report. It accuses China specifically of seeking to, in its words, displace the U.S. in the Indo-Pacific region, expand the reach of its state-driven economic model, and reorder the region in its favor. Now, before we get into this, obviously the National Security Strategy Report is a much bigger topic than our topic today, maritime, but I know you do focus on international conflict. Can I ask for your general reaction to the report since it came out just a couple days ago?
I think it broadly fits with the landscape we've seen in foreign policy from the Trump administration. So I think especially on the China front. So we've heard a lot from Trump in terms of sometimes what he calls China's unfair trade practices with respect to the United States. So that refers often to the fact that they're basically exporting more to us than we are to them. So when we have this kind of trade deficit with China, that puts China, you know, in a leverage position against the United States. More broadly, China's engaged in a very extensive investment strategy abroad. So they're engaging in a lot of foreign direct investment, infrastructure in, you know, dozens and dozens of countries, not only in Asia, but also in our own region here in South America and Central America. So part of that strategy is getting China access to resources abroad, but they're also capturing some key maritime strategic areas. So they're, for example, financing a port in Sri Lanka that will be that would allow them to ship things instead of through the Straits of Malacca to avoid that shipping area or bypass that.
Where are the Straits of Malacca?
They're near Indonesia, so they're also trying to expand their global shipping lanes, I think this is like a multi-pronged strategy in terms of the way that it's perceived in terms of aggressiveness.
Right. It's seen as very hawkish, and in contrast, in comment on this, how do you see it in contrast, broadly speaking, to the way the Obama administration perceived threats around the world?
I think, you know, if you like, on the one hand, it's, you know, it's a peaceful strategy in the sense of, you know, traditional, you know, they're providing money to other countries to build companies and infrastructure. So in that sense, I would not see it as an aggressive strategy, but it could be an aggressive strategy if you think about it from this perspective of they're a country with a large population that's growing. They're trying to secure resources for the future. So they're getting basically deals with other countries that will allow them to have access to important, you know, petroleum and other resources moving forward. And I think on the trade front, they've tended to prefer lots of bilateral deals, so negotiating with one country at a time, rather than these kind of broader free trade agreements. They participate in some of those, but yeah. So I think their strategy has been putting themselves in this kind of dominant negotiating position.
Right. So it's a matter of interpretation, whether you see this as a threat or simply a massive economic power looking after its own interests.
Yeah, I think the aggressiveness. First of all, they've invested a lot in their maritime buildup. And their naval buildup. So one of the things we've seen historically is that the countries who become hegemonic powers have to have large sea, large mm-hmm. naval fleets, strong sea powers. So there has been a shift, I would say, in the last 15 years where China's investing a lot more in, trying to build aircraft carriers and, to strengthen the naval part of its, mm-hmm. of its military strength. I do think these claims in areas like the South China Sea are not only valuable for oil and fishing resources, but also for these kind of strategic locations. So were China to engage with the USA in war, they're trying to secure access to areas for their military where if war were to break out, that would give them a strategic advantage.
Okay, so it's clear to the U.S. Strategy makers and to the Chinese strategy makers that this could be preparation for war, building, island building, and its naval patrols. That's clear. That's a given.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more, dig down now into the maritime disputes, because you've been looking at how this South China Sea dispute, which has been going on for many years, that we've been hearing about in our news because it directly affects the United States and the United States as a Pacific power, which it has been certainly since the dominant Pacific power since the end of World War II. Let's talk a little bit more about that. What is happening now right there? The Chinese have been island building. They have these craft that, blow up sand from the depths of the ocean. They're actually creating artificial islands?
Correct.
And with what purpose? Why are they doing this?
So under the Law of the Sea Convention, countries can make what are called exclusive economic zone claims, EEZ. So these are 200 nautical mile areas that extend from land that a country owns. So in the South China Sea, for example, the Philippines claim that they're making in the Scarborough Shoals fishing area, for example, that is area that extends within their 200 nautical miles from their mainland. Mm-hmm. China's claim, though, is based on what's called this nine-dash line. So if you draw 200 nautical miles from China mainland, it does not reach the area that's contested in the South China Sea. So the basis that they're making for these claims is that they have fishermen who have historically been extracting resources in these areas and using some of these islands as, basically the bases from which they would be fishing. Mm-hmm. And so China is trying to find historical documents to show that their fishermen have been in those areas for hundreds of years. But also under international law, on maritime law, countries cannot make claims from what's called a rock. And so a rock is something that at high tide would not have enough land mass above water. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a rock, then a country cannot make that 200-mile EEZ claim around that island. It's a rock rather than an island.
So we are talking about islands. So these are islands that have not been inhabited. We can't even
correct.
Okay.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to do this artificial land construction to change a rock into an island, because once it's an island, then you would be able to make a resource claim around that space.
Mm-hmm. And how is that perceived by international law that has been built up around claiming territorial waters? Does that float at all in legal terms in international law?
The Permanent Court of Arbitration ruled against China in July 2016 and in favor of the Philippines. And they basically said that artificial islands are not the basis for making these kind of claims. So just to give you maybe a little bit of background about how these claims came about. So traditionally, countries like the United States and Britain advocated for freedom of the seas, so essentially movement of all military and commercial vessels anywhere. And that freedom of the seas was protected except for an area that was 3 miles off of the coast of countries. And that came about because of it was the distance that cannons could fire off a coast. So this became the cannon
shot
rule.
That's how we arrived at 3 miles.
Yes.
Originally. So that was, you could perhaps hit a ship at 3 miles firing off a cannon from the coast.
So what initially when countries could not protect their coasts, you know, in this way, there was essentially maritime powers like the Dutch or the British were advantaged globally. And then once countries had the ability, right, in terms of military technology to protect at least up to 3 miles, that became enshrined in customary law. And then some countries started questioning that customary law because, again, technology allowed for countries, military and commercial vessels, right, to or military could start protecting outside that 3 mile area. So you saw in the 1940s, especially, there started to be claims by Scandinavian countries. Russia started making claims of up to 100 miles in off of Siberia shelf area. And then we started to see, it was especially important in 1945 when President Truman made a declaration that said that not only do we have this protection off of our coast of 3 miles, but we also have the ability to extract all resources in the continental shelf. So this was the first claim that actually was made that said countries could extract resources exclusively in a much bigger area away from the coastline.
And this was 3 miles or 200 miles?
This was where Truman's declaration doesn't denote a specific nautical mile space, but that declaration became the basis for what is now the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. So countries then started making a lot of different types of territorial sea claims, and so this is what created the impetus for there were two Law of the Sea Convention conferences, and those conferences created what is today called the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS. And that convention, which is joined by, I think, ratified by 167 countries today, spells out that countries have 12 nautical miles of territorial sea rights mm-hmm. and 200 miles of exclusive economic zone, or EEZ rights. And so those are the areas where the continental shelf goes off of a country's, you know, coastline that you can see, then the continental shelf, right, continues underwater. And so that's the area in which countries are able to extract resources. And conflicts arise because a lot of countries have overlapping 200-mile spaces.
Right,
so,
right. The globe is not cut up into neat little sections where everybody gets their own part. There are, of course, disputes. That's what we're talking about this hour with Sarah Mitchell. If you just joined us, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Her research focuses on international conflict, also maritime issues. She's also co-director of the Issue Correlates of War Project. We'll talk about that in just a moment. We're sort of focusing this hour on putting the South China Sea disputes that we hear about in our news regularly and have for very many years in the context of other maritime disputes over the past century or so to see if we can put it in a better historical context and understand it a little bit better. So when we talk about China's dispute with, specifically with the United States here, you mentioned Senkaku, other powers, regional powers in that area have had many disputes with China. This is an ongoing thing we don't necessarily hear about in our news. Describe some of the other disputes that China has had with its neighbors there in the South China Sea.
Okay, so one of the hotly contested disputes is with Japan and Taiwan as well. That's the Senkaku, as the Japanese call it, or the Diaoyu, as the Chinese call it. So mm-hmm. they, again, it's a claim about who owns the island, and then who owns the island would then determine who gets the resources around that island. Mm-hmm. This actually is a real island, as I called it before. So.
Inhabited island.
Yes, inhabited, mm-hmm. Although not very inhabited, but both sides send Coast Guard and patrols in the area. There have been, since 1990, six militarized disputes between China and Japan over this area. There was just a recent violation of airspace this week in that area, so it'll be a seventh, I think.
Has each power turned to its military to try to resolve those disputes? Have they become hot disputes?
Yeah, I think they. Well, a lot of them have been kind of Coast Guard engagements. So, typically, what happens is that one side's Coast Guard goes out. Captures a fishing vessel of the other country in that area. You see a similar kind of dispute between the United States and Canada, where in some of the salmon fishing areas that are contested, for example, in the Northwest, you would get a U.S. Coast Guard vessel that would capture a Canadian fishing vessel, and then the Canadian government would protest that. So there's been a lot of those kind of engagements.
But I'm talking about where the military situation escalates. Nobody thinks that the U.S. is going to escalate a fishing boat dispute militarily with Canada, but is it the same sort of situation in China with its neighbors?
I think to date, the Senkaku has... These disputes have, you know, they have not involved any fatalities, and they've been, yeah, these kind of lower level militarized conflicts. Some of the engagement, though, as you get more like airspace violations, I think there is a kind of escalating pattern of some of the engagements between China and Japan. And so that's probably been, in terms of military engagement, like the hottest dispute in that area. But there's also been China and Vietnam have had militarized disputes of a similar nature where they're, again, trying to defend. It sounds minor, but, you know, these happen in the we record 267 maritime conflicts of this nature globally between 1900 and 2001, and about 27% of those have at least one militarized conflict that arises between the countries involved.
When you look back nine decades and look at maritime disputes in this way, what themes pop out over when a country is willing to escalate and over what? What is it willing to fight for? What themes have you uncovered there?
So the first thing that we've discovered is, you know, what you're fighting about. So the issue at stake is really important for whether or not you get militarized conflict or peaceful negotiation. So we find, for example, one of the most interesting things we found was that if there are migratory fish stocks in an area, those conflicts are much more likely to have militarized conflict. And so what happens is that the fish... Back to my salmon example,
yeah.
The fish migrate from Canada to the U.S. and back, you know, back and forth. And so as fishermen follow those migratory stocks, you get a lot more of these militarized engagements where countries are trying to defend their EEZ areas. We also find that if oil is extracted and exported by a country out of that area, those cases are more likely to involve militarized conflict. These are both situations in the South China Sea, right, where you have both migratory stocks and oil resources at stake. Once countries have used militarized force, the chance that they will end up in future militarized engagement is much higher, you know, like 300% more likely to do it again if you've used militarized displays or uses or threats of force.
Successfully, one would assume.
Just doing it.
Going through that barrier, getting military.
So, yeah, crossing the barrier and using military force causes or creates a situation. Again, so the Senkaku, if you looked at the disputes that China is involved in with, like, the Yellow Sea in Korea, the Gulf of Tonkin, Vietnam, like, there's a series of disputes that they have. And I would say that the Senkaku is one of the – the higher likelihood, you know, cases for foreseeing military escalation, given that, like I said, there have been at least six militarized conflicts in the last two decades.
And what turns out in these conflicts where there is some show of force there, what turns out to be decisive? The military show of force gets the country with a bigger military muscle what it wants, or does international law, you mentioned the Law of the Sea Convention, is it a mix? Is it purely who's bigger, who's stronger in maritime disputes?
So what we find, I should note that another potential conflict triggering mechanism is if the countries also contest who owns the land in that area. So something like the Falkland Islands dispute between Great Britain and Argentina is a dispute both about who owns the Falkland Islands, but also who has resource extraction rights around the islands. And so it's both what we call a territorial dispute and a maritime dispute. What we find is that those are the cases that, again, have a much higher likelihood of conflict. And so you could think about in the Gulf of Maine, for example, which was a case between the U.S. and Canada, the dispute was just about where do they draw the EEZ boundary. It was not about a piece of island, right, or who owns an island in that case.
Where is this imaginary line?
It's just
line
about where is this this
line,
delimitation line.
Yeah.
Versus a case like Senkaku or the Falklands. These are actually cases, like I said, both about who owns the island and then who owns the extraction point. So we find, for example, that in our data set, there are a lot more disputes over land traditionally. So we identified, for example, 618 conflicts between pairs of countries over land borders in the same period that we had 267 maritime conflicts. So a lot more land boundary disputes, and 42% of those are militarized. So you can see that militarized conflict is much more likely over traditional land boundaries and islands. And so if you combine the ownership of an island issue with these, you know, the desire to extract resources in the sea around that island, that is a recipe for potentially for war. We did see, in fact, Britain and Argentina fighting a war.
Right. Maybe we'll have you talk about that in a moment a little bit more. We'll come back in just a moment. Sarah Mitchell is with me of the University of Iowa, professor of political science. We're sort of getting a historical context of going back decades of when maritime disputes happen, why do they happen, when they turn to be a matter of military might, when do countries choose to do that? Sort of the idea here, putting the South China Sea dispute that we've been hearing in our news lately and the rise of China in the Pacific in some context. Sarah Mitchell is with us. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sarah Mitchell is my guest this hour. She's the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, research focusing on, among other things, international conflict, maritime issues. She's co-director of the Issue Correlates of War Project, and we've been trying to put some sort of maritime disputes that we hear about occasionally in our news, chief among them recently the disputes in the South China Sea between, many countries, as we learned in the first half hour. But when we hear about it in our news, it's usually the U.S. and China playing off each other in the South China Sea. Sarah, let's talk a little bit. I mentioned there you're co-director of something called the Issue Correlates of War Project. Tell us briefly what that's about.
So this is a project that was started when I used to be a professor at Florida State, and Paul Hensel was my colleague, and he was collecting information on what we call territorial claims. So these are, as I said before, countries making claims about the ownership of land, either homeland or islands. I was interested in learning more about water-based issues. And so we got several grants to not only expand the coding of territorial issues, but also code diplomatic disagreements between two or more countries involving maritime areas. So this is, like I said, the drawing of the delimitation boundary, access to resources. So the U.S., for example, wanting its fishermen to have access to tuna fishing areas off the coast of Peru or Chile, or it could also be these kind of disagreements in terms of a rock versus an island. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of cases that look like that. Mm-hmm. And so we've identified 267 of these kind of cases globally between 1900 and 2001. For territorial issues, that's 618. And then we also code disagreements over rivers that cross borders. And so something like the Rio Grande between U.S. and Mexico was the source of disagreement with respect to water quantity and water quality. And so we also identify 143 diplomatic conflicts involving river water resources globally.
Conflicts everywhere.
So I think the contribution of our project is to provide a kind of comprehensive map of of how many of these conflicts have existed, and then we also code every peaceful and militarized attempt to settle that case.
Talk a little bit more about the peaceful part of this, because in our first half hour we talked about the Law of the Sea Convention, but there's also something called the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Talk about efforts to sort of resolve these disputes peacefully through such means. How successful is that, did you find?
So we've recorded to date probably over 4,000 attempts to settle these kind of issues peacefully. And so some of the negotiation tactics that are used, it could be bilateral negotiations. So that would be, say, Chinese and Japanese officials come together to talk about their claims in the Senkaku area. You can also have a third-party conflict management. So it could be a mediation where, say, the United States tries to help China and Japan settle their issue. It could be an international court that becomes involved. So the Permanent Court of Arbitration is an example of arbitration where a panel of judges hears a case. And in the particular case involving China and the Philippines, they ruled in favor of the Philippines. You could also have a standing international court like the International Court of Justice or the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, ITLOS. That was a court that was created by the Law of the Sea Convention. And that court has heard between the three courts, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, the International Court of Justice, and the ITLOS court, there have been about 60 or so cases that have that these courts have rendered judgments on since 1900.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at all the disputes out there, how many of these disputes are solved peacefully, resolved peacefully? Percentage-wise, is there a percentage, roughly speaking?
Well, only about 1 in 4 conflicts has any militarized conflict. So the vast majority of these maritime disputes that arise are settled with peaceful means. What's interesting, though, is that we find that international courts are by far the most effective strategy for settling disputes. So if a court renders a judgment on a disputed area, historically, countries have complied with those judgments 95% of the time.
And do all of the countries, China, for example, in this day and age, or the United States, do we always recognize these international courts? Because I think some countries don't, right? Including the U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. also is not a member of the Law of the Sea Convention, even though 167 countries have ratified. The U.S. signed but never ratified the UNCLOS treaty, which, interestingly, under the George W. Bush administration, he tried to get Congress to ratify the agreement because in terms of our claims going forward, especially in the Arctic region and the movement of our military in that region, it's better to be in the treaty than not.
The arguments against this, I can guess, would be the typical that we do not want any law above our national law would be the argument against it of signing on to such a thing, ratifying
yes.
such a thing.
And China has ratified the UNCLOS treaty. And there's an interesting part of the treaty that allows countries to bring one-sided cases to courts. So in this case, the Philippines brought China to court through the Permanent Court of Arbitration, but China did not appear in court. And the court actually ruled on the case, even though China didn't appear. So I suppose if you're a cynic about international courts, you would predict that China will not comply with the judgment. But what I would say, actually, as someone who studied these cases, is that I would predict that China and Vietnam and other states who are trying to use artificial island building as a strategy, they might stop doing that because that court ruling said that these kind of artificial constructions are not a basis for making claims under international maritime law. And so what should happen, if based on what we've seen in the past, is that that court ruling should have an important should set an important precedent for
You would expect that they might stop the island building in the South Pacific.
Yes, I think if you look at past court cases, courts, you know, while not always complied with initially, their judgments often set the stage for what becomes international law eventually. And so yeah, I have a much more optimistic take on the role of international courts.
Sarah Mitchell is with me. If you've just joined us, we're finishing up the hour talking about maritime disputes. She's studied these going back decades, back to 1900, kind of looking for themes, collecting data. She's a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. International conflict is one of her areas of research, maritime issues. Also, a couple of other areas I wanted to make sure we got to before the end of the hour. Global warming, climate change having a big impact on many aspects of life on our planet. Regarding maritime issues, the Arctic region is opening up. We are having passages open up that previously were not there. So how does this fit into the development of maritime law and the possibility of disputes? Are there a lot of disputes in the Arctic region and around the North Pole?
Well, historically, there are some disputes. The U.S. and Canada, for example, have an ongoing dispute over the Northwest Passage. So Canada claims that its land extends as far as the ice sheet that extends from its land goes. And so the U.S. in the late 1970s sent an icebreaker military vessel through the area.
To go there.
Which the Canadian government protested. And so that, believe it or not, that dispute is still ongoing. Now it's not like an active, we're going to go to war over this issue. But as that water melts, right, more of that water melts, then Canada's northward claims, right. At least in terms of its territorial sea claims, get altered by the so I think for states in the Arctic region, the melting of a lot of ice will have really important implications for creating disputes in the future, because it's going to change the baselines from which countries can make these
right.
territorial sea and EEZ claims.
Right, and unlike the South Pole, Antarctica, there is no land mass under the North Pole, so there is no territory to speak of other than frozen ice, right? So how does that complicate or figure into figuring out who has a claim to what is actually just frozen water?
Well, again, you get claims, for example, between Canada and Denmark via Denmark's holding, historical holding of territory near Greenland. So countries have ownership of some islands, which then create these kind of overlapping spaces. There's also the idea, though, that for under the Arctic Cooperation Agreement, that basically you would think about drawing a triangle from, say, Canada going all the way up to the Arctic. And mm-hmm. so the current idea is that countries that are contiguous to the Arctic would have the kind of exclusive rights over that area. And so this would obviously privilege countries like, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Canada, U.S., and so on. But there are other countries like China who are actually trying to alter the terms of that, who will get these resources in the Arctic. So China is trying to make claims as well in the Arctic. Right now it's, I think there have been agreements, but there's a real shift in, I think we'll see a lot more conflicts in this area as ice melts and there's greater access for military and commercial vessels in that area than we'll get. Mm-hmm.
So you got to be talking competing. About shipping lanes opening up that weren't there before, but also resources. Are there especially valuable resources? Do we know what resources are in the top of the world, so to speak, that might be desirable?
I think there was a thought historically that there was going to be a lot of hydrocarbon resources in that
meaning
area.
Meaning what? Hydrocarbon resources,
like oil,
fossil fuels.
Natural gas. But I think so far, some of the extraction that's happened, even like north of Alaska, some of the companies that have tried to extract their to test for potential hydrocarbons are not, they're not so far coming up with a huge amount of resources in some of these areas. I think on the one hand, that could change again because drilling technology has evolved significantly over the past few decades. So the depth at which companies can extract resources is much deeper today. And so there were areas of the South China Sea that, say, 30 years ago, China was contesting it, but not as interested as it is today because they didn't have the technology to drill for oil in the way that they do today. And so I think like the combination of like better extraction technology and the melting of ice, so opening up better access to that area, I would predict a lot more disputes in the future over Arctic areas.
Unlike these carbon fuels, fossil fuels as resources, fishing, fish stocks are, I guess you would say, a renewable resource that people want to claim, that countries want to claim to fish in. Now, I guess whether they're renewable or not depends on how well you take care of them, right?
Right.
And we know that our fish stocks in many parts of the world are extremely depleted. Does that figure into the disputes, fishing stocks, and how well one country wants to take care of a disputed area where there are a lot of fish compared to another country who might see a more short-term view of, let's get the fish?
We actually studied, we looked at two mechanisms for kind of managing your resources. So one is what we call privatization. So that's just establishing a, say, 200-mile EEZ off your coast. And the idea would be that if you have exclusive rights over a property, you're more likely to treat it well. So, like, it's like if you own a home, you will be,
right.
a better person living in the home than if you're renting a home. So we do see that the declaration of those EEZ zones leads to an improvement in fish stocks. But we also see that countries who join the Law of the Sea Convention see improvements in their fishing stocks over time. So we actually
encourages people to be good stewards of their areas.
Exactly. And so, but the problem, like I said, is that you get migration of fish. So in some of the disputes between Canada and Spain and Portugal, for example, the fish are kind of hovering near the 200-mile EEZ boundary. And so there was a 60 Minutes story about this a few years ago about how Canada is actually patrolling outside of this 200-mile boundary, right, because a lot of the fish move outside that boundary. And then Portuguese and Spanish trawlers, right, are sitting in that area ready to extract those resources. And so this is in the Law of the Sea Convention, they call this the area. So this is the area of the sea that's not owned by any country under these rules of delimitation. So the treaty actually tries to address how resources can be extracted and managed in the area. And one of the reasons that the United States wanted, or at least Bush wanted us to ratify this treaty, was because of some of those provisions for how the U.S. could have rights in these open sea areas.
Mm-hmm. International conflict, maritime issues, the focus of a lot of Sarah Mitchell's research. She's a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Finishing up this hour, I didn't want to let it get away from this hour get away from us without addressing something that I think everybody thinks of when they think of maritime disputes, piracy. Piracy has existed through all the decades that you looked at. Did you look at piracy specifically in any way? Did you find any themes, any changes over the decade? We still have it today, right?
Correct. There was actually quite a bit of piracy that emerged in the Gulf of Aden area off the coast of Somalia. So we don't explicitly code piracy in our data set because our data covers basically you have to be an official nation state, right, to enter our data set. But Brandon Prinz at the University of Tennessee and Ursula Daxecker, who's at Utrecht, I think, in the Netherlands, they have a project where they have coded every piracy incident from 1946 to the present. And that was a project that was funded by the Department of Defense. And so they've actually cataloged every piracy attack. And so what they find is, not surprisingly, that countries that have weak governance, like Somalia, or poor economies, those become like the places, right, where you've had a lot of piracy activity. So countries that have a lot of civil wars also tend to have more piracy off the coast. But there have been efforts by the United States and other governments to try to patrol some of these kind of hotbed piracy areas. And there has been, I think, an improvement, and there's been a decline in some frequency of piracy attacks more recently because of, I think, this kind of joint effort by the United States and European countries to try to monitor what these pirates are doing.
Mm-hmm. To finish up in the last couple minutes here, Sarah, what do you see when you look forward after having reviewed all this data from nine decades of maritime disputes, looking at what caused them, what's likely to turn into a military maritime dispute? When we look forward, are we likely to see more maritime disputes or tailing off? Are we going to see more or fewer military actions when it comes to disputes in international waters or territorial waters?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is there's been a decline in traditional land boundary disputes. So disputes involving, say, homeland in particular, so who owns a piece of land, like Kashmir, those have been historically the number one leading cause of war going back centuries. And so the good news, I guess, is that those are declining. However, we are seeing a rise over the past century in the frequency of disputes involving water. And so now, so far, those have been militarized, but not to the level of a lot of people being killed. So they've, you know, the engagement has been, I think, at a lower level of conflicts, which is good. But on the other hand, I think the potential for water to become a point of conflict in the future, I think, is definitely a possibility. You know, in the 80s, a lot of people warned about the future water wars that were coming. And interestingly, like, we never really saw a lot of water wars between countries. But in some of my other work, I find that water conflicts between countries like Syria and Turkey actually make the possibility of civil war in those countries much more likely. And so what seems to have happened is that we were looking for water wars between countries, but some of the violence that's happening because of water disputes is actually closer to home, so to speak. And so I think that's going to be another I think we might see a lot more terrorist activities and civil wars because of water conflicts in the future.
All right, we'll leave it there. Fascinating work you're doing there, your research. Sarah Mitchell, F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Been looking this hour at sort of putting the South China Sea disputes, other maritime disputes in historical context. Sarah, so glad to have you with us. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. ¶¶